And welcome to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And I am your host today, and it's Wednesday, a little after 11 a.m. Central Time, and we're on until 1 p.m. today. And we're going to be talking about a number of different subjects. Last week we had some difficulty taking calls, so we'll go ahead and take calls today throughout the program and try and catch up on some of those things we missed last week. The call-in line, if you'd like to call in, is 800-313-9443. Again, that's 800-313-9443. And I'm Dr. Nick Begich, and we're with Changing the Way We See the World today. And today's topics, we want to cover a couple of different things. I want to get into a discussion a little bit about some of the other technologies that are being utilized today. One of them that we've written about in the past, the underwater sonars, we're going to cover just a little bit. That's some of the new Navy sonars that are being used in the oceans throughout the world. We're also going to talk just a little bit about cell phones and cell phone safety as we get into the conversation today. Again, the call-in number is 800-313-9443, and hopefully people will be able to get through today without any difficulty. We're on a landline today, trying to work out our communications from Alaska, so we're probably a little bit soft on the voice, but we'll try and make up for that throughout the day. And, you know, today's program, this is the fourth one that we've done, and, you know, we're trying to keep these on a number of topics, try and get some general information out there. The last three programs we've done are, of course, archived at rbnlive.com. You know, the issue of underwater sonars kind of pops up periodically in the media. It got quite a bit of controversy over the years. And, you know, generally what you hear about are generally associated with military exercises. You hear about beaching of marine mammals and different species in the oceans. And, you know, there's been a lot of confusion about that over the years, and some of that confusion has started to get sorted out, even by the Navy's own admissions that perhaps some of their new sonar equipment is actually creating problems. And kind of going back historically, you know, sonars, the idea was to be able to locate, you know, submarines and craft in the oceans, you know, and be able to find them. The equivalent of being able to locate aircraft in the air using radar. Well, sonar, the way sound travels in the oceans is pretty unique. You know, sound in air, you know, people hearing my voice today, the sound will strike the surface of the body of individuals hearing my voice, and 99.97% of the energy in that sound just bounces off or reflects away. Very, very little of the sound is actually absorbed into the tissue of the human body or anything else for that matter. In the oceans, on the other hand, sound traveling through the seas actually strikes tissue, and all of the energy in that sound is actually absorbed and passes through that tissue until it hits cavities or air spaces. In the case of humans, it's the lung cavities, nasal passages, and so on. And when that energy reaches those areas, the energy is released dramatically, especially when you're talking about the energy levels used in the new underwater sonars. And let me talk a little bit about sort of what happens. I mean, if you think about sound traveling in the seas, if you think about it at all, it follows a very simple, similar pattern to the way shortwave works within the atmosphere. Shortwave radio broadcasts, in fact, many of our listeners listen via shortwave. That signal actually gets trapped in the atmosphere and bounces between a layer above the Earth's surface called the ionosphere, and this layer is about 30 miles up. That sound shortwave signal actually bounces between the Earth and the ionosphere and allows it to bounce literally around the globe, so you can hear this station literally around the world. In the case of the oceans, what happens with sound is it also gets trapped, but it gets trapped in ocean layers that are based on the differences in temperature. As you get deeper and deeper in the seas, the temperatures get cooler, and the salt level within the oceans changes based upon that temperature as well. And what happens is there is actually a ducted layer, a layer within the oceans where sound very easily transfers and gets trapped, so a sound signal will literally move hundreds, even thousands of miles around the globe. In fact, this is the way On some species, such as whales, actually communicate. They produce a sound, and that sound signal gets trapped, and they can actually hear that sound hundreds and hundreds of miles away. Well, by watching marine mammals, the military has noted, you know, sort of what was happening. You know, they made the observations, and they saw how easily this system worked and for locating each other, and so they started to apply some of these principles to the underwater sonars. Now, with active sonars, those are the ones that actually send out, you know, the old ping signal, and you'd wait and listen, you know, for that signal to come back. With active sonars, by pushing a signal out, the idea is that you'll be able to locate undersea crafts. And for instance, submarines used to make a lot of noise, so you just had to listen. You know, and if you listen long enough and you had a couple of listening stations, you could triangulate and locate the position of that submarine. But now, with the advent of silent submarines, the need for an active sonar system that can create a signal that can locate those submarines that travel silently through the seas. And why that is important is it's one of the very few military platforms that can get close into our shores without detection. So that was the impetus behind these new sonars, and most people can see the merit of it. The problem comes in with the energy levels. And what has happened over the last little over a decade is they began testing these systems. They were using energy concentrations, very low energy concentrations compared to what they wanted to do eventually. And what would happen is they would literally drive the animals crazy. In fact, multi-species beachings we were seeing around the world, and people say, well, you know, it's just a few animals, but those are the ones that made it to the beach. Now, what we also know is that it's not just marine mammals that have air pockets within their body. In fact, almost every species of fish, and anyone who's gone fishing knows this, when you clean out a fish, within their digestive tract, often you'll find gas pockets or pockets of methane or other gases that are forming within the digestive tract. And so what happens is, with those species as well, when this acoustic wave, this sound wave, travels through their tissue and strikes that gap or that open space, what happens is the energy is released dramatically. It almost is the same as when you surface too fast from being really deep in the seas, and you get this symptom called the bends, where blood vessels break and you get hemorrhaging. This is exactly the same thing that is being reported with marine mammals. And so it looks like they've surfaced too fast, which is, you know, kind of ridiculous, because marine mammals have been surfacing for years. And the thought was, well, the Navy first came out and said, oh, they're just frightened by the sound. Well, then when they actually analyzed the animals, they found, no, they weren't frightened by the sound. Their hearing mechanisms, digestive systems, lungs were all being negatively affected by the energy exchange that was taking place. So pretty dramatic change, and what you see now all around the world is periodic reports of these beachings. Some may in fact be natural, but since 1963 or 64, almost all of these occurrences are in the area of naval exercises. Now, in the last few years, they've advanced even new systems, more powerful systems, that have been tested in the seas at 1/5,000th of the eventual level of energy. In other words, just a fraction of the energy anticipated being used in these systems is actually responsible and has been responsible for many of these problems. Now, it's not just marine mammals, but human beings also spend a good bit of time within the seas, which makes us also susceptible to exactly the same kinds of problems. And there's been some anecdotal reports of divers when these tests are going on being affected negatively by these same acoustic waves. What we also know in terms of this whole adventure is the way in which it was first pursued. You know, at first there were absolutely no scientific assessments to see what this might do. Those came after. In fact, it was after a lot of litigation by the normal suspects in terms of changing the thing and getting people to be a little bit more responsible. In the end, they settled the lawsuit, and the lawsuit settlement basically said they wouldn't test this equipment anymore, except with a couple of exceptions. And one was Southeast Asia, which is kind of interesting because, you know, as we said, sound travels, you know, literally hundreds, even thousands of miles. So that doesn't really change a whole lot. The other was during wartime. They said they would continue to test during wartime and maybe even deploy the system during wartime. And, you know, I mean, and I think we can look around, even though we haven't seen the formal congressional declarations of war, mainly because we're looking for the state to declare it on, I suppose. But the real reason is because this technology is so valued by military planners, the desire to use it goes on. You know, what time is it? I mean, we are in wartime from the administration's perspective, and from their perspective, they're continuing to advance the system. The risks come in not just for marine mammals, but literally a major portion of life in the seas could be wiped out by this type of technology. When it was first pursued back in the 1950s, in fact, this technology was ignored. It was put out that nobody would do this because of the risks associated with it. You know, and there's a lot more to the story. You know, if you're interested in talking about this story, the topics we've covered in the past, the call-in number again is 800-313-9443. Again, 800-313-9443. Going back to this story, the sonars, you know, as they began to be deployed, we saw more and more agitation in the seas. I hear the music coming up. When we come back after the break, we'll take your calls, 800-313-9443, and continue on with a discussion of underwater sonars. This is Nick Begich with Changing the Way We See the World. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we're on every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time right here on RBN Live. And we appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. We were just talking before the break about the underwater sonars and sort of how we got wrapped up into this issue. And I'd mentioned Marsha Green had invited us to this conference in Bar Harbor, Maine. And this conference was at the, I believe it was the College of the Atlantic or the University of the Atlantic. It was sponsored by one of the commissioners of the National Marine Mammals Commission. And it brought together a number of scientists from around the world, those that were specialists in underwater acoustics, some of the underwater sonar effects, really taking a look at that issue, as well as a number of representatives from the various organizations that traditionally get involved in these kinds of issues. And I asked Marsh, I said, you know, sonars really aren't my thing. You know, I don't really follow them, but why would you want me involved with this, you know, this group of individuals? And she said, look, it's not just about what's happening in the seas in terms of technology and its impacts. It's also what's happening generally. And she said, you know, you speak on the HARP issue and what's sort of happening on the surface of the earth and in the atmosphere, and you cover all of these other topics that deal with sort of the invisible side of technology, those things that generate various kinds of radiations, various kinds of energy forms, including, in this case, sound or acoustic energy. And having an understanding of that and its impact on living organisms is a valuable thing. So she said, what you're here to do is really help educate some of these organizations that just don't see where this technology is headed, because it's not just about the sonars. I said, okay, you know, that's interesting. So we went ahead and participated in the conference and, you know, had the opportunity to meet literally the experts on this subject. And what we found is that it followed the same pattern as most issues. You know, there's some very important issues that get sort of their media coverage in the 30-second soundbite on the 6 o'clock news once every 7 or 8 months, and otherwise you never hear about this stuff. And the problem is some of these things have perhaps greater impact and much greater impact than the nonsense we often hear on the mainstream media, because these situations also require a little bit of education in order to interpret the information. You know, a reporter is only as good as the questions they ask, and the questions they ask are always based on the information they have. And so when you have technical subjects that get into these kinds of areas where you have to have, I mean, to even have a discussion on radio, we're going to spend an hour today talking about this issue and not the 30 seconds that you get on the 6 o'clock news. The problem is there's not enough technical reporters that are really looking at the impact of science and technology on all of us. And this is a huge problem today, because when you look at technology around the world, what makes a government strong in the 21st century, and it's the technology they command. You know, it's, if you look at where the power bases are left in the world, it's always, and in this century, it, and it will always be, those with the highest technology. The United States being, at this point, the first real superpower, the first dominant superpower since the Romans were around a couple thousand years ago. So the responsibilities also go with the technology today. We're not dealing with swords and catapults. We're dealing with energy as the basic form of energy used for new weapons applications, whether it's for detection, things like the underwater sonars, or whether it's used for more aggressive weapon systems that we've covered in the past and likely will cover in the future. But here we have a system that, you know, is sort of under the public's screen of observation. You know, we just don't see it. And periodically we have events occur. A bunch of animals wash up on the shore and everybody gets excited. And, you know, then they frame it in the typical frame. You know, they get the left and right arguing with each other about environmentalism and the causes and the effects. And what we have to remember is this isn't an argument about who's at fault. The Navy has acknowledged the fault. The problem now is, what do we do with the information? And how do we translate that information in terms of the overall effects in the sea? At the same time, we're trying to guard our national security. And this is, again, an area where open discussion, at least conceptually, there are other ways to detect silent submarines that perhaps offer a better safety valve for the rest of us living on the surface of this planet. And this is the balancing act between security, environmental considerations, as well as our general responsibility towards stewardship with respect to the planet itself. And I think there's a balancing act there that we can achieve without giving up national security to do it. And I think this is, again, where we've got to have this broader, wider discussion, not how to build this stuff so our adversaries have an advantage, but we ought to have a discussion about what these things do so we understand clearly what trade-offs are being made. And some of those trade-offs, quite frankly, are going to be made because, you know, those are the kinds of decisions that we're in fact going to have to make over the next couple of decades. How we approach it is important. Moreover, how do we deal with the impacts of our technology are also important. And, you know, in that end, you know, over the last 12 years, we've been reporting on these various issues, and the role we've chosen to take is one of technology reporter, taking on these issues that are complicated, trying to slice through the science, meet with the right experts, so we can bring to people a coherent conversation about the impacts and directions in which this technology is going. In that regard, we've gotten a lot of help over the years, and one of those sources of help has been the Lay Institute on Technology, which is a Texas-based nonprofit organization. It was set up by Dorothy Lay. She's one of the heirs to Herman Lay, who founded one of the largest corporations in Texas. It's it was the Frito-Lay company, and also later merged with PepsiCo there in Dallas, where he ran that company for a number of years. Well, Dorothy started looking at technology and became concerned. She'd been following our work for a number of years and asked us to participate on her board and began to educate the public on these big issues. And so we began that relationship about a year and a half ago. Since that time, we set up a website, and this website is thelayinstitute.org. It's layinstitute.org, O-R-G. And if you go to that site, it gives you the purposes of the corporation, but it also gives you a very useful resource. What we have started to do is load our archives, all of the records and documents that we've collected over the years, we began to load into that system so that you can do word searches under any of the keywords or the topics that we cover on these programs and actually take a look at many of the source documents that we use to make our case. And these source documents at present, we have 700 documents loaded into that system. So you can go to what's called EPI Search on the layinstitute.org site, and you can actually go through keywords and you'll find all of those documents and where they came from on these various topics that we cover. And this, we think, is a useful thing because we've got about 20,000 documents to load in. Those are the ones still waiting to be keyed and loaded in, and we're adding to our archives probably 200 to 300 documents a month at the present time. When you start to look at that, as sort of a consolidated resource, we want to make that available, and it is available for free to members of the public who are just curious about these things, researchers who are pursuing these issues a lot more aggressively, media and political leaders, others that have an interest in having the information so they can be educated on these very important topics that are going to be hitting us literally throughout the next decade. You know, and oftentimes, you know, we try to blame, you know, all kinds of groups for our problems. But, you know, the blame doesn't need to be placed at this point. You know, you've got a lot of scientists aggressively pursuing their interests, not necessarily understanding how their particular branch of science might impact someone else. And this came out of sort of the U.S. and West approach to scientific research over the last 40, 50 years. And we've taken this sort of Cold War approach of compartmentalizing, separating the very important sciences into very small subcomponents. So you have specialty upon specialty upon specialty, and no one really talks to each other. And the problem becomes over-specialization, separation of sciences in such a way that you cannot get a cohesive, complete picture of how these sciences interrelate and interact. And this is, again, something that I had mentioned in previous shows is exactly the opposite of what our old Cold War adversaries did. Instead of compartmentalization, the only way that the Chinese and the Russians and others could keep up with us was the opposite. They put multidisciplinary teams, people from all branches of the sciences together in one room at one time to search out the solutions for technical problems. And the result was dramatic. And you saw it. I mean, for 40 years, we had a country that could never keep up with us creatively, at least we thought, or productively, which we know, and yet technically, they could keep up. And it was the manner in which they approached the science in the first place. The first scientific paper that I ever delivered was in 1978 when I was 19 years old, and it was on a conference. And the paper I delivered was contrasting the U.S. approach to scientific research, this compartmentalization approach, against the Soviet approach of generalization approach. And what was clear then and is clear now is a generalist approach gives us the best information to make the best decisions because it gets us an advantage. In the case of the Soviets, when it comes to energy as a system that affects human beings, their safety standards at the end of the Cold War were 1,000 times more stringent, more strict than those in the West in the United States. Now, why was that? It was because they had made the observations of how energy actually relates to living organisms in a way that convinced them without any question about risks associated with energy itself and the way in which that energy is managed or manipulated. And this is, again, where many of the technologies that we've been talking about the last few weeks have centered on this idea that energy, when manipulated in specific ways, is just as powerful, maybe more powerful, than a bullet or a bomb or these traditional methods of affecting our health. And yet, at the same time, the understanding of sort of what underlies the human mechanism and living organisms, the energy itself, can also lead to the opposite, an understanding of the health and physiology of human beings and other living organisms so that we can, in fact, use energy as the route for curing many of the problems that we've seen. And you see it periodically. Energy medicine comes out in the media periodically with new breakthroughs, things that never were thought possible, as we begin to rethink the old physiological models of how the body actually works. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that today because this is a very important point as we start to look at the spectrum of things that now impact all of us. And you see it in the populations, because these technologies and their side effects actually create increased levels of stress and anxiety, and you're seeing it. You're seeing it in epidemic proportions, particularly in the industrialized world, where we're exposed to these fields on a regular and continuing basis. And it's interesting to see now, as the debate continues and as the debate grows, how many more people are beginning to see the difference in the old chemical models. And part of that is in the way science evolves in the first place, how the sciences end up separating the physics and the math and the energy relationships sort of flow one direction, and the chemistry And those types of sciences flow in another direction, and they don't talk to each other. And every chemical reaction, every chemical event within an organism has as its root an energy exchange, an exchange of energy that the physicist understands and can even produce the math to explain. And it's that disconnect within the health sciences that has led to a lot of misunderstanding. And it's changing. I mean, it's the old story is, you know, when 50 years passes, science really goes through dramatic changes, and it kind of lines up with when people pass on after their doctoral dissertations are long forgotten and they're not around to defend old ideas, that new ideas have room to come forward. And we see it periodically. People think science is a pure thing, that everyone is objective and everyone is cooperative. And in fact, that is not the case at all. In fact, it's probably one of the most competitive areas of human interaction on the world today. And the same human emotions come into play of jealousy and envy and contempt for other ideas that people don't understand. I mean, there's all of those things that human beings do to defend what they believe is right and true, and science is, of course, no different. The big differences are coming as new theories and new ideas about how things work come forward, and more than that, how old theories die and are replaced by what we consider to be sort of a factual base. We get past the idea of wondering how things happen to the point where we say, okay, we know how this happens. And, you know, that transition has not occurred with a lot of the sciences that surround us today. And part of that is the gap between public education and the gap between innovation, because innovation is happening so rapidly today. And I've said it before, you know, technology, everything that we see today, from the invention of the wheel to the latest gadget on the market, in 9 to 10 months, all of that technology will double again and keep doubling for all of our lifetimes and the foreseeable future, just based on what we know today. Yet, the discussion, the impact of all of that technology does not take place. You know, in the case of sonars, the reason it's a big issue is because the intent of our military and our allies is to put this system in 80% of the world's oceans. At that level, we can almost guarantee that we'll see a decrease in fish stocks and seafood populations of animals within the seas by probably as much as a third, based on the research that other scientists have produced. And yet, this issue continues to move forward, both in the United States and elsewhere, without a whole lot of objection. And it begins to be characterized as this sort of left-right debate, and it's not. It gets right back down to this fundamental question is, you know, if it's a question of stewardship and good sense, let's make sure that the technologies develop, serve the interest of humanity, serve the interests of our national and sovereign securities across the world, but at the same time, don't jeopardize the very things, the very systems that every one of us on this planet and generations to come will be dependent upon. And that doesn't mean that we have to scale back our lives to the point where we're all living in huts. I don't think that's the case at all. I think we have abundance on the planet. It's a matter of re-looking at how we do things, not a case of scarcity and not enough to go around. I think that's just the opposite of what the facts have begun to show. When we get into all of this technology, always there's questions about, you know, where does it go from here? And what we know is it goes to higher and higher energy levels as these systems are brought forward. And as resistance, the water is sort of tested to see if the resistance is there to slow them down. And at this point, the resistance hasn't appeared. And this is one of the very important issues of the 21st century. I hear the music coming up. We are going to go to a break. And when we come back, again, the call-in number is 800-313-9443. And you're listening to Dr. Nick Begich with Changing the Way We See the World. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we are listening to RBN Live. And we're with you every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And we're coming to you from Alaska, which is my home. And so today's topic, we've been talking about a little bit about the underwater sonars, and we're going to talk about cell phones after into the next hour. Again, we've got call-ins at 800-313-9443. And it looks like we have Daniel on from Wisconsin. Daniel, are you with me?
Hello. Can you tell me why conservatives are so opposed to the idea of global warming?
Well, I think what we've seen is the same kind of things we saw in Europe initially, is industry is really opposed this issue in terms of taking it on and taking any responsibility for it. It's not true in the European community. You know, conservatives in Europe, one of the leading conservatives, the chairman of the environmental subcommittee of the European Parliament, a conservative from Great Britain, at one time was our champion in the European Parliament on many of these issues, because they're not looked at as liberal or conservative. They're looked at from the perspective of stewardship. In the case of the United States, you know, global warming, the consensus among scientists globally, and this is everyone in the community, is climate is changing. Now, the majority of scientists are asserting it's man-made. Others are asserting that it's natural. Most that are really looking at it recognize it's probably a little bit of both. And the natural swings, according to Eastern Bloc, the old Eastern Bloc scientists are saying, is predominantly natural. So the debate is how much of it is man and how much of it is nature. And, you know, we had done a program on climate change that's archived there at RBN Live. And a lot of it has to do with the energy sources and those that are benefiting by the status quo. And that's where you see the big propaganda from both sides, quite frankly. The reality is climate is changing by both natural and man-made occurrences. I believe personally that it's predominantly natural, but I also believe that the way governments are addressing it is fundamentally flawed. We have to recognize the changes are taking place, quit worrying about who's to blame, and recognize that if we don't recognize the change and take a look at how it's going to affect long-term agriculture and all of the other living systems that affect us on this planet, we are all going to be losers. It's time to not look at it as a left-right issue, but understand it as a stewardship question and a real question of natural occurrences creating changes that we must address in the long run.
Have you heard that under the Arctic Ocean, that there's about half of the world's oil reserves, and once that ice melts, it'll be open to exploitation by the oil companies?
Right. In fact, we talked about this both in the program we had done here on RBN, and we also have a DVD that gets into that issue called Earth Changes, and it's at our website, earthpulse.com. When we got into this, you know, here in Alaska, the largest domestic supply of oil is the Prudhoe Bay field, and there's a lot of discussion now about the field on the right, the Anwar, which is, you know, big discussion about oil reserves. What people don't realize is exactly what you said. The entire Arctic, everything under the Arctic Ocean is considered an oil basin, and this is open for really huge possibilities. And when we get into the next hour, we're going to cover the rest of this question. So after the break, we'll come back. Daniel, thanks for being with me. And again, if callers want to call in, it's 800-313-9443. And you're listening to RBN Live with Dr. Nick Begich. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And you're listening to RBN Live, the Republic Broadcasting Network. And we are on every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time. And today we've been talking a little bit about the sonars. We got a caller, Daniel, had asked me about the climate change issue. And we were just talking before the break about some of the impacts. And one of the big questions he asked, which I think is a very relevant question, is the oil basin under the Arctic Ocean. You know, if you look at a globe, what you'll see is the major oil fields in the former Soviet Union in Siberia reaching up into the same region. The Arctic potentially has enough oil to probably replace what we're getting out of even Saudi Arabia, according to reports here in Alaska about what's possible on the North Slope of Alaska. And it also affects Canada and the former Soviet Union. There's going to be a lot of fights and debate about what happens in the Arctic, because already the Arctic seas, in terms of the ice, has retreated about 40%, That's been caused by a combination of factors, but the reality of that is well documented here in Alaska. In the video we produced a while back on Earth changes, we got into this quite a bit because national energy policy and climate change issues are totally related to one another. You know, right now they're having huge discussion in Alaska about building a gas line. We have trillions and trillions of cubic feet of natural gas on the North Slope that have been locked up by the oil industry since 1969 when they first gained the rights to produce it. They never have produced it. They produced the oil from Prudhoe Bay, but not the natural gas. Now what we know is the entire North Slope of Alaska, everything north of the Brooks Range, has potential as an oil basin. And when you get offshore, you get into even more potential, and some of that offshore has actually been drilled. If you get to look at a map of the oil development on Prudhoe Bay, you'll see that we have stretched the field further and further into the Arctic Ocean. We'll continue to do that because that's where the oil is. The other issue is sea routes. If you look at the recession of Arctic sea ice as it continues to melt, it's opening sea routes from Europe into Asia. And if you look again at a globe versus going the Panama Canal route, this is a much, much shorter route into Asia. So you think about transportation routes changing, we're going to see that. It's going to head towards the Arctic. And this is where the northern parts of Canada, there's lots of assertions over territorial claims now. The Russians as well, and the United States, and other European countries in the north are arguing about who owns what, because not just the natural resource potential, but who will control those shipping lanes that are going to dramatically change the way in which freight, oil, and commodities are transferred around the planet. So all those things are playing in right now. As you know, climate change has all kinds of implications. This is just one of them. And again, you know, these things all get wrapped back together. You know, technology, again, gets kind of back to the root of this. You know, in order to fuel the technological society that we've built and the culture we built around the planet, the need for fuel sources isn't going to go down. It's going to continue to increase. We're seeing growth rates in India approaching 10% annually. We're seeing growth rates in China 13 to 14%. And that's indicative of the entire Asian region. Right now, the biggest contributors to global pollution, if you will, are Asian countries, not the United States or the traditional industrialized countries. You know, we've taken responsibility to an extent, and we've regulated our emissions as much as we feel are rational, and through the proper kinds of political and scientific debates, we set standards. Well, it doesn't matter whether we have that standard if the rest of the world is ignoring it, and too much of the world is. It's been one of the reasons the U.S. has been reluctant to sign some of these accords that restrict us economically, while our competitors are not so restricted. So all of this requires a greater understanding, greater sense of responsibility, and where human interests guide rather than multinational interests guide. And we're coming up on a break again, and you're listening to RBN Live, and I'm Dr. Nick Begich, and this is Changing the Way We See the World, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and I'm coming to you from Alaska today. And we started talking about the underwater sonars. We kind of drifted a little bit into some of the energy issues, which is fine. While we're on that issue, I want to mention an article I've just read. It's actually out of the Forward from Technology Review, which is MIT's technology journal. This is this month's issue, the May-June 2006 issue. And there's an article called Hydrogen on the Cheap, and it talks about a new General Electric breakthrough, actually a major breakthrough in this area, where they were able to create a low-cost electrolyzer, a way to get hydrogen out of just water. And in fact, they were able to lower the cost. You know, when you compare a kilogram or about 2.2 pounds of hydrogen to the equivalent of about a gallon of gasoline, as an example, to get the same energy out, it takes about a kilogram of hydrogen. Well, hydrogen to produce a kilogram, or the equivalent of a gallon of gas, is now down to $3, down from $8 by just this one technical change by General Electric. What does that mean? That means that technically we can get devices out there now that are relatively low cost, that can be made available to produce energy at a cost that's sort of stabilized at around $3, the equivalent of $3 a gallon for gasoline. That's just one breakthrough by General Electric, and a relatively simple one when you read the article. When you start to look at those kinds of changes that are possible that could dramatically change the whole game, where the whole issue of, you know, of Arctic oil as an example and this huge oil base, you know, oil is going to be with us for a long time. No matter what alternative is popped out of technology today, it's going to take a while to see that actually begin to carve away at the impacts of oil. But we need to do that work now. I mean, when we see companies like General Electric investing not billions, not hundreds of millions, but a few million dollars to make a breakthrough like this, what are we doing? You know, we're spending $1 trillion in the Middle East right now rebuilding a country over an energy resource that $1 trillion invested in this kind of capital would solve that energy problem for a major section of this country as well as the rest of the world. It might even create a new industrial base for this country producing the kind of hardware and equipment that these new technological innovations are going to require. We need to reindustrialize the United States through our innovation, through the leading edge technologies that have the potential to not just improve our own economic situation, but literally change the world. You look historically at the United States and our contribution to science and technology and the contributions of Europeans and everyone around the world, but you look at the United States and what have we contributed technology over these many decades. You know, air flight, a lot of that innovation came from U.S. innovators as well as European innovators. When you look at radio and electronics, you know, it was the United States that was the leader in bringing about many of those revolutions that changed literally this entire planet. Automobiles and transportation systems, every major enterprise, and today we sit on the threshold of opportunity to literally change the world again in a much, much different way using scientific innovation from traditional Western sources as well as our new allies. And here we've got to look at things from a different perspective again. Where does the technology serve our interests, and how do you balance the advances against the value of those innovations? You know, the other issue I wanted to cover today a little bit is this whole issue of cell phones and cell phone safety. And, you know, this whole matter has certainly changed everything in communications around the planet. When you think about even 100 years ago, you know, how did people communicate? You know, if you wanted to reach somebody, you either mailed a letter or you started walking around town trying to figure out where somebody was, because we didn't have telephones, we didn't have radios, we didn't have any of the forms of communication that we have today. Today, you can be literally anywhere and receive your communications via cell phones or satellite phones. So they're not going to go away, but we have to look at what's going on with these devices. And periodically, over the years, we've seen bits and pieces of news come out on this story, as with the underwater sonar issue, and yet they kind of come and go. We never get a full, complete picture of what we're trying to be told in a short 30-second press report. For the cell phone issues, I've got a lengthy article with over 90 source documents that are cited, and that's at my website at earthpulse.com, earthpulse.com. And if you go to that site, you'll see lots of articles and information that we provide for free on these issues. You'll also see references to some of our educational materials that we've produced over the years, videos and books on the subject. The cell phone issue and the underwater sonar issues are both major sections of a book I wrote with James Roderick a few years ago called Earth Rising 2, and that's with the Roman numeral 2. And what you'll see in that book are four main subjects. You'll see the underwater sonar subject. You'll see this issue of cell phones dealt with, the idea of technologies that impact personal safety and security as well as personal privacy are discussed, as well as other issues in terms of technology. But the cell phone issue, where it became highly controversial, and you'll remember this maybe from the late 1990s when there was an event in Florida where somebody had a brain tumor and they associated that with their excessive use of cell phones. And that resulted in a lawsuit and a lot of controversy. The lawsuit really didn't move anywhere, except it did influence the United States Congress to begin to make inquiries of the cell phone industry as to the impacts of that technology on human health. And so as a result, the Congress insisted that the industry engage in a study, and so Motorola and others funded a $25 million five-year study on the effects of cell phones on human health and physiology. And the guy they hired was a guy named Dr. George Carlo, and George Carlo was considered one of the scientific experts, high credibility, incredible guy in terms of his history. So he was hired to run the program, and after 5 years, going through all the literature, reviewing all this technology and science, and hiring a team of world-renowned experts, he issued his report. And immediately on issue of that report, the industry held press conferences around the world and claimed everything was wonderful and everything was safe. And George Carlo came forward and said, wait a minute, you've misinterpreted my material. I did not say that. And he actually published a book called Cell Phones, Invisible Hazards in the Wireless Age. And what he said essentially was there were safety risks. He even explains the mechanism by which he thinks tumor formation actually happens within the brains of individuals and how that might occur. And what he suggested in this book is that the energy, the heat exchange from the cell phone, sticking a microwave broadcaster and receiver next to your head, which is essentially what a cell phone is, that it creates a heat transfer into the head, and that heat transfer actually breaks down what's called the blood-brain barrier, that barrier that keeps toxic materials from reaching the brain, breaks it down and allows those toxins to flow into the brain, and that's what he believes also slows down the repair, the natural occurring repair of DNA, so that you don't have that repair occurring, which results in cells not understanding the signal correctly and mutating and creating what are known as tumors. And if you look around, think about the people that we've heard about in the mainstream media that had died from brain tumors. We should never hear about that. Now we hear about it all the time. And it's people like Johnny Cochran who are on the cell phone, you know, 9 or 10 hours a day. You take a look at the people that are experiencing this, and you're going to see an epidemic with CEOs, heads of busy corporations that are on these devices all the time. You're going to see it with people that use them in the course of their work, and you're going to see a huge, huge change. And when you look at the studies that have been done that have involved in Scandinavia, over 15,000 people showing that they create, these are the things that are reported. After a use of an hour use a day, you know, cumulative through the day, what they're showing is people are experiencing things like interference with sleep patterns, interference with short-term and long-term memory, fatigue, interference with sex drive, and the formation of tumors within the brain, as well as heating behind the ear. Lots of different indicators showing statistically, over large thousands of people, these problems are occurring. Now, what they also know is that with children, and this comes out in European literature, almost every year at the beginning of school, you hear these press reports in Great Britain particularly, where they announce to parents, you know, don't get your kid's cell phone if they're under the age of 16. And the reason for that is the skull itself. If you look at the skull of a five-year-old, and you consider the energy that's transferring from the cell phone or the home portable phone, which operates on the exact same principles, that energy transfers directly into the brain of a five-year-old at 400% more energy because of skull thickness alone transfers into the developing brain of a young child. At 10 years old, double the amount, 200% of the energy travels into the brain. And then in an adult. And this actually comes out in George Carlo's research, again, expressing concern over young people using these home portable phones as well as these cell phones. And there's been a lot of discussion about that, in terms of what it does and how it works. And we're going to continue to talk about that through this hour. I've got Beth in California that's standing by, and I'm going to go ahead and take that call and continue this conversation on cell phones, or what do you want to talk to me about, Beth? You've got something on your mind today.
Yes, I do. I was trying to reference the article on my web, on my email that I'm going to talk to you about. Maybe you've heard about it. I live in San Diego, and a few months ago, it was public mainstream news here that a sound wave generated 65 miles off the shore of Mission Bay from a site that's a military site that had previously not been identified. It came on to land, and it continued through land 135 miles. Indicated that the sound wave was so large, it took 10 seconds to pass under one site, for example, under your feet.
Beth, hang on. We got the music coming up. I want to continue this right after the break, so stick with me. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich, and you're listening to RBN Live, and it is a program we're bringing to you every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Central Time, and we have Beth on the line. Beth, go ahead and continue your comments so we can take that fully in.
I've been able to find that reference over break, and I'm referencing an article in the Union Tribune of San Diego written by Alex Ross, April 27th, 2006. And it says, Scripps scientist says sound waves traveled over the ocean to the desert. And, in fact, on April 4th, it describes a sound wave that generated in an area 65 miles outside of Mission Bay in San Diego called Warning Area 291, which is referenced as a huge swath of ocean used for military exercises in the Navy. That sound wave went 165 miles inland. It created so much damage that at first it was believed to be a meteorite hitting, and it took a day for that to be ruled out. Then they knew it was not an earthquake. There was no seismic activity. Then they tracked it down to a sound wave. And they indicated in this article that the sound wave was of a magnitude that it took 10 seconds to pass through a site, such as under your feet. And it had such little impact on the people in San Diego. I was horrified by it. I sent it everywhere, and no one seemed to be able to understand the magnitude of this small incident,
right.
Sound wave of this size and magnitude that went through that much water and that much land and did that much damage.
Right. This is, I would appreciate if you would forward that to me. You know, go to my website, earthpulse.com. This is something everyone can do. You know, there's a lot of news stories like this one that don't make it on the AP newswire, so we never get to see it outside of a region. And these are the very important stories that help bring this together. You know, that underwater site, these types of sound emitters are what's used in the underwater sonars. And you're absolutely right. They'll transfer sound very efficiently, goes through solid material. The problem comes in, and this is where the real risks are, is if you create certain resonances or harmonies in the materials that sound wave is traveling through, you can actually cause the release of tremendous amounts of energy that are naturally in place. In the case of California, where you have a heavily faulted area where energy is being stored in these fault zones because of movements within the earth, many have suggested, because if you look at earthquake activity, you get an ELF, an extremely low frequency signal, this pulsing coherent signal that they pick up. Many have suggested that you can trigger earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, using electromagnetic fields or acoustic waves. In fact, there's a study being done and has been done by Dr. Ben Eastland looking at acoustic waves and their effect on entire weather systems. What we know is that if you hit specific resonant frequencies or harmonies, you can trigger these events. There was a press report that came out by the Department of Defense, and it was after a conference on weapons of mass destruction back in 1997, before the 9/11 event. And Secretary of Defense William Cohen suggested that even terrorists could evolve these technologies. What that zone of warning is, are again, for those submarines coming into our coast, I would guess, and this is just a guess on my part, that test to see what would happen in terms of ground penetration of the earth, if you think about submarines, you also have to think about underground submarine bases on the coastal areas where you want to be able to chart and map those. And what you can do, just like analyzing the returning reflected signal off of a submarine from these underwater sound sources, you can also analyze the signal going through the earth and the return components of that signal to determine the exact character of the underground structures, to locate military facilities and the like. This is probably what that test was about. The problem comes in is if you inadvertently hit one of these what are called window frequencies, you can trigger natural releases of energy. And window frequencies can be looked at the same way people dialed through if they're listening to some of the FM stations that picked this program up or their shortwave station. They dial through the stations, and when they get resonance and harmony between the transmitter and receiver, they get a nice clear signal. The same is true within the Earth. Only the clear signals that the Earth understands trigger natural events. The same kind of signals that the human body understands triggers chemical reactions. So when you look at energy being used in this way, most of it, granted, is static between the stations, no effect at all. But if they inadvertently or purposefully hit one of these zones of a window frequency, a much different effect occurs. I'm glad you brought this up because it's a very important issue, and it's the kind of story we appreciate getting information on. So please send us the article, and we'll integrate it into our work.
I will. I wanted to make a very brief comment of fact that's relevant to this. They said the sound wave moved at 320 meters per second. I'm reading this, roughly the speed that sound travels through the air. And I was wondering if that had a significance, the fact that it could move through water and land at the same speed of unobstructed air, if that indicated it was an unusual kind of sound wave.
Well, it does, because generally sound travels more efficiently in solid material in terms of water and air, and you can actually look at the in the book Earth Rising 2, we get a discussion of how sound travels in air versus water, and the dynamics are quite different. So yes, it is significant.
I'll get that out to you. Thank you, and I support your program.
Well, thanks, Beth. I appreciate it. And again, the call-in number is 800-313-9443, and you're listening to RBN Live, and we're headed for a break, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And we are coming to you from Alaska today. And we've been talking about a couple different topics, talking about a little bit about the underwater sonars as well as cell phones. Beth, who was our last caller, had brought up a really valuable piece of information. You know, this press story out of the Union Tribune from it actually came out April 27, 2006, talking about the sound transfers within the sea, and then actually within land taking place down there. You know, these are important bits of information. You know, over the years, people have actually contributed a great deal to the work of Earth Pulse by providing to us articles like that. You know, when you see those articles, don't just assume that we have them. You know, pass them on. You can go to our website at earthpulse.com and get our contact information. Please do send that information on. We can certainly use it. I also mentioned that we had this a research site. It's the layinstitute.org site. And on that site, we're actually taking that kind of material and summarizing it and then posting it, making it available to a larger and larger groups of individuals and researchers so we can begin to knit this story together. You know, that's the way investigative reporting is done. People get in the libraries, they start digging out these bits and pieces of information, and many people over the years have contributed to our research by doing exactly that. And it's an opportunity to sort of get involved, be a committee of one, take it upon yourself to do that, and then we'll help bring that story to the rest of the public through radio broadcasts and written material that we're involved in. You know, when we were talking a little bit about cell phones, we got into a lot of discussion in our research. There's a very good article, again, at earthpulse.com on the details of that story. In the meantime, I've got Bruce in Omaha standing by. Bruce, are you with me? Bruce, are you there?
I have a little static on my line. Did you hear that?
I can hear you now, so go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I've got a couple things. But one is... you know, when I was working for RCA and Andros in the 70s, the Wasat lab next door to our Forex lab was tracking an old Soviet Z-class that looked like it was heading toward Cuba across the far reaches of the Tongue out there off the east coast of Andros, just using the acoustic propeller as a signature. And, you know, we could identify their subs, and they could do the same to us just by the propeller signature.
Right, right. And this is, you know, each sound signal is unique. You know, it's like the fingerprint. That word signature you can equate to the fingerprint of a technological device, and every electronic discharge from any electronic device can pin down exactly what it is, mm-hmm. and give you that kind of information.
Exactly. One other thing I wanted to discuss is, I think in the first half hour or so, you were talking about using the frequencies and electronics to cure disease and such.
Right.
Well, you know, I give you the book Lost Science by Gary Vassilatos.
Right.
About Royal Raymond Rife in there, and his frequency generator and his optical prismatic microscope that's been suppressed since then, because evidently the pharmaceuticals don't want this cure known to the people.
That's exactly right.
Various frequency DC pulses that can cure disease, can kill the living cancer virus, can kill arthritis virus, and such, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's amazing what's been suppressed in this world.
That's right. You know, that book, Suppressed Inventions, was a great one. One of my colleagues, Gene Manning, wrote a chapter in that book on suppressed energy inventions as an example.
Science?
That's right.
Yeah.
The idea of, the whole idea of energy interactions and physical health, you know, when you think about Raymond Rife's work,
mm-hmm.
And if you look at, there's a more recent researcher, and I'll give you the website. It's www.emred.fi, and FI stands for Finland. And you'll see the site.
Emred Finland, emred.fi.
Yep, and what
you'll FI, you say?
Yes.
Okay.
And so you go www.emred.fi, and what you'll see there is the research work of Anu Michaela. Her father was one of my mentors in electrophysiology.
Mm-hmm.
And what she has done is actually analyze using modern techniques, and has created a electrolaser acupuncture method that had been invented originally by her father and
mm-hmm.
advanced by her for doing exactly the same thing. And she is has a physics background, a chemistry background, a medical background, and a background in physiology, is a brilliant, one of the most brilliant researchers I've met around the world, and is on this issue. And she's not alone. There's a number of researchers. In fact, in that instance, her father was challenged by Finnish medical authorities years ago when he was claiming cures for diabetes, for various forms of cancer, and they challenged him to their highest court in the country, and he won. He actually was able to prove through 16,000 case studies that he was right, and now there are 15 trained medical practitioners in electrolaser acupuncture in Finland. One of them, my acupuncturist here in Alaska, actually went over and got training before Reho passed on, and his daughter carries on that work. It's being spread throughout Europe, and we expect that in the next decade, we're going to see electromedicine take the proper place that it should, because wherein lies the cure is an understanding of human health, beginning at an energetic level and then moving out from there and manifesting itself into chemical reactions in the body.
Oh,
so it's coming, Bruce.
Yeah, when I get off the air, I got to hurry up and write that down because if I forget it and have a senior moment. emred.fi, right?
That's right. And we'll post information as we come across it on the website. This is an important issue, and we'll be writing more about this issue in the coming months. Bruce, thanks for your call. And I have Jeff standing by, looks like in New Mexico. Jeff, are you there?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, have you ever heard of physicist Fritjof Capra?
The name's familiar, but I'm not placing from where.
He's got a book here, The Hidden Connections. He mentions Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute having to do with hydrogen technology. Are you familiar with this Amory Lovins?
I haven't seen that work, no.
But he talks about these hydrogen fuel cell cars that you can actually, when you're not using the car, you'd take it home and it would feed into the grid, you know.
Continue to produce energy so it was available. Yeah, great idea. You know, and when you think about a number of things, you know, the Finnish, or not the Finnish, but the Icelandic government actually does this.
This book talks about the big project in Iceland, too.
And it's incredible. What they've done there is actually take the electrical energy is generated by geothermal power, which is sort of this ongoing thousands and thousands of years of energy geothermal generates for electricity, and then the excess electricity at night is used for cracking hydrogen out of water and then giving hydrogen, making hydrogen available. Now, if you combine what the Icelanders are doing in terms of hydrogen with this new breakthrough by General Electric, the cost will now drive the cost down of that energy to a lower cost in Iceland, in the case of Iceland, than the cost of using gasoline. So now it's cracked that sort of economic threshold that offers the greatest opportunity. And again, it's the connecting of technology. And this is where shortwave broadcasts like this, where ideas can be exchanged and then people can start to pick that information out and link people together. This is something everyone listening can do. When you hear good references, don't assume that the experts in your own countries have that information. Pass a copy of the reference on. It may trigger the next creative breakthrough that solves some of our major problems, and every one of us can participate in that.
Yeah, and he says in the book here, Fritjof Capra, that through Amory Lovins, that a full U.S. fleet of hydrogen-powered hypercars would have 5 to 10 times the generating capacity of the national electric grid, save all the oil OPEC now sells, and reduce America's CO2 emissions by about 2/3.
Right, right. And here's another impact, is the economic impact of not having a trade imbalance generated primarily by our consumption of foreign oil. That is a big, would be a big, big change in terms of our balance of trade, as well as the value of our dollars, and particularly if we were building the hardware and exporting that hardware to the rest of the world. So not only do we eliminate an import, we maybe create some exports for a change.
Yeah, I think a problem is the macho image that so many guys have, that they got to have a big gas-guzzling vehicle to show they're a man or something. There's too much of that.
Well, I guess that's part of our character, but you know, that image starts to fade when gas hits $5 a gallon. I think that's where we're headed. People need to recognize that, you know, who we are isn't represented by the car we drive. It's a whole lot better than that. But I agree with you. It's just part of our character. Hopefully, the economic considerations start to weigh on that a little bit. But, you know, people should have the right to drive what they feel comfortable in. At the same time, they're paying the price for it. And, you know, these alternatives don't mean you have to settle for less. You know, right now, you know, either scale down, because we're just learning how these technologies work. But as they advance, we're going to have the ability to have those big cars that people seem to want. But that doesn't mean they don't have to be, or they can't be, efficient in terms of what type of energy they use. And I think that's, again, a case of the technology just hasn't advanced far enough to allow all of those kinds of options that the traditional combustion motor has provided for us.
Yeah, and these hypercars they're made out of a composite material, the body?
Yeah.
Which is actually supposed to be stronger, and so they're safe, too, even though they're small. You could probably get hit by a big SUV the way they're made now. I mean, the steel ones, you know.
Right.
You could probably get hit by one in one of these composite hypercars and not get hurt, because they're safe, too. And then, of course, because they're light, you're being more safe as far as if you hit somebody with your car.
Right, right. And, you know, again, technology is advancing in material science and the evolution of stronger and lighter materials, again, making vehicles safer generally. The idea of new materials, you know, each of these new industries, as they come forward, they tend to breed huge innovations in multiple areas, not just the one that we're actually targeting. And this is, again, where that cross-fertilization, because industry uses multi-disciplinary approaches. They get a lot of different people thinking about the problem. And as they evolve their solutions, they start to integrate material science with energy sciences and creating better and better systems. And where the big innovations are coming is from those parts of the world that are totally dependent on energy. Japan is becoming one of those. You know, one of the big concerns, too, is China and India's production of automobiles. You know, that's coming, and that's going to have a dramatic impact on U.S. industry. You know, the last surviving industry in this country of any size is the automobile industry, and it is at risk, a huge risk, because of now what will soon be, by 2009, automobile imports. I mean, we need to look at where can we get an advantage again in our root industries, and it's going to be on the innovative side, and we need to begin looking at how do we compete by producing a more efficient automobile that's not just demanded in the United States, but might be demanded elsewhere. And again, our innovation is ahead of everyone's, but applying that innovation just doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen because of competing interests. If you look at corporate boards on these multinational corporations and the interlocking boards, you start to get the picture of why some things get suppressed when these interests are so entangled that high fuel cost actually supports an automobile industry that currently exists in the country. You know, you start to see, you know, sort of how these things tie together. It makes a lot more sense. But it doesn't make sense from the average citizen's component, only from a multinational corporate perspective. And that is not the perspective anyone listening to this broadcast generally has, because we're all in our own sovereign countries thinking about how do we advance our own interests without necessarily impacting someone else in an adverse way. And the multinational approach is just the opposite. Engage in everybody's business, create a market as big as you can for everyone to look at things in the same way. And this isn't the way it works. I mean, in real life, people are very different. Our needs are very different. But more importantly, the issues that underlie the industrial advances need some discussion. So we make sure they really do line up. And they're the best technologies available. Right now, that market is not perfect, but it's changing because people are looking for the answers. Hey, Jeff, I appreciate your call, and I'm going to go ahead and get back into this other issue a little bit, because I want to cover a little bit more on cell phones before we lose the rest of this hour. If there's other callers, you can certainly call in at 800-313-9443, and you're listening to RBN Live, and I'm Dr. Nick Begich. Now, I want to mention two things. Is on the cell phone issue that keeps getting missed is the fact that this issue continues to come up. And the one point I want to make is there are some things that you can do to be a little bit more safe with the cell phone that you have. One of them is when you have the opportunity to get a new cell phone, think about getting the speaker phone, the ones you hold a foot or so away from the head and you speak into the microphone, and then it has a speaker that speaks back to you, so you don't have to put the instrument next to the head. That is an excellent solution to the bigger part of this problem. The other thing that is often done is people use these earplugs where you can put a little earbud in and then you can actually listen and talk and so on. Those are generally pretty good, but a lot of times they're cheaply made and they don't have much of an insulating quality, so they actually end up acting as a shunt or a guide for energy to flow into the ear, so they oftentimes don't achieve the purpose you're looking for. A simple solution for that is to make sure you get a good quality unit. And then the other solution is, if you're in doubt, they have these little buds that you can put on communication cables. You can get them at any of the electronic stores, and they take care of radio interference or electrical interference, and they're put on little cables, and they snap on. If you snap one of those on just before it goes in to the inner ear, it'll actually dissipate the signal that might be shunted up. Won't interfere with your ability to hear the cell phone call, but will get rid of that energy that's otherwise just shunting straight into the head. So there's some things you can do. The industry is also increasing the safety and efficiency of circuits. Although they don't acknowledge the problem, the more efficient the use of energy within a cell phone, the longer batteries work. So there's other reasons for industry to try and solve some of these problems. But when you look at cell phones and the radiation coming off of cell phones, there were actually studies back in the 1960s, before cell phones were ever invented, dealing with exactly the same energy concentrations, exactly the same frequency band that are involved now in cell phone communication. And what they found in 5 out of the 6 Navy studies is that they resulted in deformations in the DNA or in chick embryos based upon interference of those signals. And so it isn't something new. It's just not being applied. The technology and the understanding is not being applied. And this is, again, where the disconnect. Things kind of move forward on their own very rapidly today without a lot of discussion or a lot of analysis. And because the whole issue of electromagnetic field interference, even RF, things of cell phones in the body are still being sorted out by the experts around the world. We'll be back for the last segment right after the break, and you're listening to Dr. Nick Begich on RBN Live. And welcome back to Changing the Way We See the World with Dr. Nick Begich. And I'm coming to you from Alaska, and you're listening to RBN Live. And we are on every Wednesday from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m., so pass that on to others and tune in to us again next week. We've been talking about two separate topics today, the cell phone issue, and we've also been talking about the underwater sonars. We got into a little bit of side issues on energy, which is fine. You know, this idea of a changing energy economy, I think, is an important one, and one that we ought to be a lot more aggressive in. You know, if you think back to the oil embargoes, the last time that we were all standing in line waiting for a gallon of gas, the United States actually invigorated a search for alternatives, and there was a lot of innovation back then in that area, because we offered some tax incentives, we offered some other incentives that didn't cost an awful lot of money, but led to some pretty interesting breakthroughs. Unfortunately, you know, we didn't learn the same lessons. You know, the Brazilians did the same thing, only what they ended up with, as a country that produces very little at that time in the 70s of their own energy, they are totally energy independent today, something the United States should have been able to say by now, and we've just not done it. The idea of these new energy sources being evolved by other industrialized countries is going to be the biggest loss if we don't jump on it. You know, our industrial inventive innovation in the government and in the private sector. General Electric is becoming one of the leaders in hydrogen research in terms of finding cheap sources and ways to develop it. You know, these are going to continue to advance. And as we find those solutions, therein lies a lot of potential. You know, the idea of thin solar films now, something that is getting cheaper and cheaper to produce, are now economic. They were economic in many parts of the world before. As we look at the already changing dynamic of energy costs, we can address this now economically with existing technologies if we just put the money, time, and effort behind it. And we could make it, you know, the basis of not another foreign import, you know, but something that's actually developed within the existing industrialized countries of the world. It doesn't have to be farmed out. These are don't take as much labor as they take innovation and hardware, and the hardware that's being developed ought to be being exported around the world to start to solve some of these very problems. You know, the issues we've covered today are in books and DVD formats. You can find them at earthpulse.com, earthpulse.com, which is my website. Research materials used for this program are available at thelayinstitute.org. There's a lot of information there, and listeners can help us by collecting materials on these topics and others of interest on technology, making sure they get to us, and we'll share them with other listeners in the future. Next week when we're on, I'm not sure what topic we're going to cover, but we'll get into some of these topics we've covered over the years on technology, kind of amplify those. We'll take callers again, of course, and then we're going to start lining up a few guests here for future programs on some of these issues, bring in some of the scientists I've met around the world and some of the activists that don't generally get on the radio, and have an opportunity to talk about some of the innovative approaches that they're taking in the science. So I'm hoping to bring that to you over the coming weeks. Again, the call-in number for today is 800-313-9443. And kind of to summarize on the sonars and the cell phones, what we're really talking about is energy and the impact of energy on society. This is not going to go away. It's the beginning of a whole change. Changing the Way We See the World is the name of the program. I'm Dr. Nick Begich. Thanks for being with me today. Tune in again next week on Wednesday at 11 a.m. Central Time.